Hello, it's Monday, March the 30th. I'm Sonia Rothwell. In today's podcast, the political battles have started already as the G20 summit gets closer.
And the Europeans now feel vindicated that the mess we're in now is due to the unbridled capitalism that has been preached to them for the past 15, 20 years by London and New York and Washington, and they are not prepared to go down that road.
Personal and political mortification for the Home Secretary as the taxpayer is billed for porn watched by her husband.
That Jackie didn't know what her husband was watching is because Jackie doesn't spend very much time in that house, seemed to be suggested to me.
And the US tries a new, more picturesque route into Afghanistan.
Takes you through kind of rolling green pasture full of red poppies and lilac flowers. It's a very fragrant spring landscape and a kind of delightful trip.
All that to come, but first, Bill Overton's here with today's headlines and a look at the papers.
Ministers are struggling to maintain momentum for this week's G20 summit, which takes place in London. It's emerged that any spending decisions will be deferred to a later meeting, which further narrows the scope of the talks. Yesterday, the Australian Prime Minister Kevin Rudd said it's up to the International Monetary Fund to determine how much additional support the world economy will need next year, and that there had never been any expectation that decisions on the package would be taken in London. The summit is predicted to attract more demonstrations later in the week. A police training academy in Pakistan's been attacked by an armed group with hand grenades and assault rifles. Officials say at least 8 people have been killed, with more than 20 police injured near the city of Lahore. The academy is on the road between Lahore and the border with India. 8 people are dead after a gunman opened fire at a nursing home in the US state of North Carolina. 6 were killed at the scene in the town of Carthage, while 2 others died later in hospital. A police officer and the gunman were among those injured in the incident. A local district attorney says a 45-year-old man is under arrest and will be charged with 8 murders. The chief executive of the struggling US car company General Motors has stepped down after intervention from the White House. Rick Wagoner will leave his post immediately. GM has already received billions in government bailouts as it tries to weather the global downturn, but says it still needs more. President Barack Obama says car companies need to do more to justify further aid. Meanwhile, France's biggest car maker, Peugeot Citroën, has sacked its chairman, Christian Strafe. The company recently announced huge losses and job cuts and says it has removed Strafe because of the extraordinary difficulties facing the industry. And in sport, Fabio Capello's ruled out recalling Michael Owen to the England squad. Capello needs a replacement for the injured Emil Heskey ahead of Wednesday's World Cup qualifier against Ukraine. Owen's injury problems have frustrated his attempts to make an impression under Capello, who says, "I have to choose the players in good form. I choose the best players who are in a very fantastic moment." Now for a look at this morning's papers, and many of them pick up on the row precipitated by Home Secretary Jackie Smith's husband. Blue Labour screams the Mirror. 2 blue movies, 1 domestic row, and red faces all round is the Guardian's lead. While The Telegraph says that Ms Smith is now fighting for her political career. According to the Mail, the Home Secretary could face axe. While The Express goes further, "Shamed Smith must quit now," is the headline there. Elsewhere, the Financial Times looks ahead to this week's G20 meeting in London. The paper carries an interview with Barack Obama in which the US president plays down the risk of a split between the US and Europe and calls for the summit to deliver a strong message of unity for the sake of the global economy. The paper also says that taxpayers will pick up £750 million in toxic loans from Scotland's largest building society. Chancellor Alistair Darling is expected to tell the House of Commons today that it would have cost up to £100 million to keep the Dunfermline going. The front page of The Times shows Jenson Button spraying a bottle of champagne after his win at the Australian Grand Prix under the banner "Button speeds to victory after years in slow lane." The paper also carries a story on changes to rules covering maternity leave. It cites a report which says maternity leave should be cut and new paid leave given to fathers. And on the subject of maternity, The Sun has followed Madonna on her latest trip to Malawi, where it's claimed she's about to adopt another child. The star's pictured with her daughter in the African nation, with the headline, "Meet Your New Sister, Madge Takes Lourdes to See Mercy." Keep up with breaking news and sport throughout the day on guardian.co.uk.
It's been called an eve of summit ambush, as German Chancellor Angela Merkel signalled her reluctance to spend more money to try to ease the global economy out of recession. With only 4 days to go before the G20 meets in London, I asked The Guardian's Ian Traynor in Brussels if a split is appearing.
No, I'd say the contrary, actually. I'd say that both sides, transatlantic sides, are converging on a common position for the Thursday summit. There are fundamental differences between them, but these have been out in the open and have been aired for several months. I'd say as the G20 approaches on Thursday, the differences are narrowing, but there are still gaps in perception and emphasis and nuance, and basically how the White House on the one hand, and particularly Angela Merkel in Berlin, wants to see the priorities set as for the future action on tackling, what has been called casino capitalism.
So can you just outline for us what the Germans actually want from this, compared with what, say, Britain, US and France want from this?
Well, Gordon Brown has been put in the, obviously a rather difficult position of trying to bridge the difference between Europe, continental Europe, and the new administration in Washington. To simplify, basically, the Americans prefer public spending, so-called fiscal stimulus, tax cuts, big public infrastructure programs to try and revive the economy, whereas the Europeans, more broadly, and the Germans in particular, are intensely suspicious of this and are worried about the American proposals. Having said that, everyone agrees that two things have to happen as a result of the G20. One is better regulation of the markets, of the kind of laissez-faire economics that have got us into this mess in the first place. That's the European priority, as well as fiscal stimulus, which is the American priority. While there's agreement on both of these aspects, the differences are, as I say, of emphasis and of priority, and how, where, and when you go about the ordering the various policies that you're taking. The Americans are still emphasizing the need for so-called fiscal stimulus, and have been critical of the lack of European support here. Angela Merkel, who has an election, very tough election to win in September, is absolutely adamant that they will not be announcing any more big public spending programs, and that they will wait to see whether the programs that they're already implementing are actually going to work. It's the differences are rooted in history and in different, very different cultures. You have Anglo-Saxon or Anglo-American free market capitalism that's dominated for the past 20 years. And on the continent of Europe, you have what is called the social market economy, which is more controlled, more regulated, less laissez-faire. And the Europeans now feel vindicated that the mess we're in now is due to the unbridled capitalism that has been preached to them for the past 15, 20 years by London and New York and Washington. And they are not prepared to go down that road. Having said all that, these are fundamental differences, but I would say that all the signs are that Merkel, in particular in the European camp, is coming to London looking for a deal. And as she says, she's not coming to compete, she's coming to cooperate.
Having said that, there are signs from most of the leaders that expectations are being played down somewhat in ahead of the summit. What should we read into that?
Well, I think expectations have been played down, given that Gordon Brown is between a rock and a hard place, and in recent months the British in particular have been talking up the importance of the G20 summit in London, and everybody's playing politics with it, of course. I mean, if Merkel's got an election in September, Gordon Brown's got a political career to revive, and nobody quite knew what to expect of the new White House team. They're very new in the job, and we've been waiting to see what they would propose. So everything has been in a certain flux. The expectations have been scaled back, but it appears from Brussels and from Europe that the kind of backing down is coming from the Anglo-American side. We're hearing less and less from Downing Street of the kind of American emphasis on fiscal stimulus as the summit nears, whereas the Europeans, whether it's Barroso in the European Commission, whether it's people like Juncker in Luxembourg, Sarkozy in Paris, and Merkel in Berlin, are not backing down at all. They're saying they're worried about the American proposals, and they're sticking to their guns.
Europe editor Ian Traynor. And there's more analysis of that summit at guardian.co.uk/business. Meanwhile, as the Prime Minister tries to convince G20 leaders to back his ideas to rescue the world's economy, other problems are brewing for him much closer to home. The Dunfermline Building Society, whose head office is next to Mr. Brown's Fife constituency, looks set to be broken up, following estimated losses of £26 million. Our Scotland correspondent Severin Carell has been following the story.
Well, it's now emerged that the Dunfermline has in fact built up some £800 million worth of investments in property, both £650 million in commercial property and £150 million in what appear to be subprime mortgages in England, which has left it in a pretty parlous state. I mean, clearly before the international financial system collapsed, these investments may appear to have been fairly smart, but they're now incredibly risky. And at the same time, the Society's also appears to have lost £9 million on refurbishing and modernising its own IT system. Over the weekend, Jim Foulds, the chairman of the Dunfermline Building Society, has confirmed that it will be admitting losses of £26 million, perhaps as early as today, as the full extent of its financial problems has become clear.
This must be really embarrassing for Gordon Brown, especially given the timing of the news and the fact that the headquarters of the Dunfermline is on the edge of his constituency.
It's certainly making his life extremely uncomfortable. I think the most obvious political problem he's going to face is that this building society, as you say, which is on the edge of his own constituency in Fife, will be in trouble just as all of the world leaders meet up for G20 in London on the 1st of April. However, the political embarrassment for him is more to do with the fact that the opposition parties in Scotland, particularly the Liberal Democrats and the Scottish National Party, who have the most to gain politically in Fife from Labour losing any credibility, is more to do with the rough and tumble of politics. I think the fact that he's a Scottish Prime Minister and the fact that the Chancellor, Alistair Darling, is also Scottish, presumably means that they've been working even harder than one might expect to try and rescue the Dunfermline Building Society, because they clearly wouldn't want to allow this building society to collapse right on the Prime Minister's doorstep. However, the problem that the opposition parties face is that once the true extent of the building society's losses do become clear later today and over the coming weeks, then it may be very difficult for them to sustain the argument that this is either the Chancellor's fault or in fact Gordon Brown's fault. If the Dunfermline's board and its management have, as the government insists, been pretty reckless in the way they've been investing their own money, then it may be quite difficult to pin too much blame on the government. But even so, with G20 about to begin, other world leaders were turning around and saying, well, Chancellor and Prime Minister, it's all very well for you to start lecturing us about probity, but if a bank on your borders on the edge of your constituency can't survive, then who are you to lecture us?
This must be really embarrassing for Gordon Brown, especially given the timing of the news and the fact that the headquarters of the Dunfermline is on the edge of his constituency.
Indeed, I think the greatest embarrassment will almost certainly be the proximity of this particular building society's collapse with the G20 meeting starting in London on the 1st. The difficulty, of course, will be that other world leaders, particularly non-Western countries, will be pointing at the Prime Minister and saying, look, you can't lecture us if a building society right on your own doorstep is collapsing because of its very poor investments. The political embarrassment internally, you know, domestically, will be a bit more problematic, I think, because although clearly the Prime Minister and the Scottish Chancellor would not want Scotland's last major building society to go bust in this way, presumably they'll be well aware of the political difficulties of allowing it to collapse if it were able to be saved. Now, if it turns out that the building society did in fact have toxic investments and unwise investments of the scale that the Chancellor has indicated, then it may turn out to be that the opposition parties that are now attacking the Chancellor and the Prime Minister will look a little foolish, because if the building society was as badly run as it now appears to have been, then it clearly is nobody's fault other than Dunfermline's fault.
Now, What's going to happen next? As you say, there's quite a lot that's going to come out in the next few weeks, we imagine.
Well, yes. Well, Jim Foulds himself revealed that there are two building societies and two banks that are in talks with the FSA about taking over its most profitable and secure operations, which are chiefly in the savings side. Now, it's expected that the FSA will actually announce this morning what the proposals are for the Dunfermline, that it will be broken up. Its profitable wing will be bought by one of the building societies or banks in the running, and its toxic investments will have to be bought up by the taxpayer, and they will try and have to find, you know, the FSA and the Treasury and the Bank of England will have to try and find some mechanism for converting these toxic holdings into a more secure and profitable investment.
Severin Carell. And across the rest of The Guardian's website today, a British woman who faces execution for murder in the United States has made a final bid to have her case retried. Guardian.co.uk/world. It's bound to be popular with washing powder manufacturers, but is England's new all-white kit a hit elsewhere? Guardian.co.uk/football. Well, at least they're wearing something, unlike a French pole vaulter who's posted a film of himself running naked through Paris in an effort to get a new sponsorship deal. All will be revealed, maybe, at guardian.co.uk/newsblog. Coming up, the controversial French rapper who's united the political left and right by annoying them both.
What he normally raps about is the sort of boredom and hopelessness of French provincial teenagers and sort of rural drug epidemics. But this is a song which dates back 2 years, and it's about what he wants to do, beating up his girlfriend who he caught cheating.
But first, hot on the heels of controversy over a second home allowance, Home Secretary Jackie Smith now faces having to pay back money she claimed for porn watched by her husband, Richard Timney. Ms. Smith and Mr. Timney have apologised over the matter, but questions about her probity are still ringing around the media. Allegra Stratton has been looking into the story. I don't know who this is more embarrassing for, the government or Jackie Smith's husband. Has the Home Secretary actually done anything wrong here?
I've had her aide on the phone saying that Mr. Timney will certainly be sleeping on the sofa for the foreseeable future. There's a related problem, which is that we don't quite know where Jackie Smith lives. Timney, her husband, has been claiming expenses on their television package up at the constituency home, and Jackie Smith is supposed to be living down in London with her sister, and the related controversy is which is her first home, which is her second, but that's a sort of separate issue. One of the things that her aide suggested to me was, you know, the couple are, they not quite estranged, but the couple seem to, you know, that Jackie didn't know what her husband was watching is because Jackie doesn't spend very much time in that house, seemed to be suggested to me. So it's all very murky, and it doesn't look very good for our Home Secretary, really. It's not necessarily the movies. I mean, you know, we were doing stories a couple of weeks ago about Jackie Smith being tipped to be reshuffled out of the cabinet should Gordon Brown do a reshuffle. So I don't think that it's necessarily two lots of adult movie subscriptions, but this is a murky addition to an already quite shaky platform.
Like you said, it doesn't look so good coming so soon after the first set of revelations. Is she under pressure to resign?
Yes, she is. But, I mean, it's quite interesting because the Tory front bench are not saying anything today. I was talking to one of their press officers, and she said, no, we won't be putting anyone up on this. That's an official position, but they'll be sort of jumping up and down. Lots of backbenchers are speaking about it. It's just the front bench taking a decision not to. No, she can't resign over this because, you know, there is a difference between what... I think that people will argue there's a difference between the Home Secretary and then what her husband does. The problem is that it adds to the murky perception of what MPs are doing about their expenses. And the thing is, in the next few months, we will get more and more information about all of these dodgy receipts. There's supposed to be a whole complete compilation of everything that MPs have claimed over the last 4 years. It will come out, and we'll have many, many more stories of this ilk running and running in Sunday newspapers. It was Tony McNulty last week. It's Harry Cohen, a Labour backbencher, this morning. It's obviously Jackie Smith this morning. There'll be lots, lots more. Smith is also, you have to remember, very vulnerable in her constituency. She's a cabinet minister that sits on the most marginal seat. You know, arguably Gordon could get rid of her to give her more time to spend with her constituency.
Allegra Stratton. The new hope to help the US and NATO secure success in Afghanistan is a different transit route into the country from neighbouring Tajikistan. The literal change of direction avoids the perilous tribal areas of Pakistan and the ambush-prone Khyber Pass, which have caused such problems. The Guardian's Luke Harding is in the Tajik capital, Dushanbe.
Well, the problem that Obama faces, having just unveiled this ambitious new Afghan strategy to crush the Taliban and Al-Qaeda, if you like, in Afghanistan and Pakistan, is that the convoys which are supplying US and NATO forces in Afghanistan are being repeatedly ambushed. Basically, they're threading through the kind of perilous tribal regions of Pakistan and up through the Khyber Pass. You know, and I've traveled that road, and it's a very dangerous road and extremely kind of ambush-prone. Now, because of that, following on from Obama announcing that he's going to boost the number of troops there by another 21,000, what NATO is doing is signing a whole series of bilateral deals with Afghanistan's northern neighbors. Now, these are the former Soviet republics of Tajikistan, Uzbekistan, Kyrgyzstan, Kazakhstan, Turkmenistan. And really, they're going to sort of collectively form a kind of new corridor with non-military supplies in trucks rolling across the border. I think it's quite interesting, really, this kind of new focus on Central Asia. There's nothing new about kind of strategic rivalry here. There's this expression, the Great Game, which was coined to describe the kind of competition, if you like, between Imperial Britain and Tsarist Russia in the 19th century, which was played out against the mountains of the Pamirs and the Hindu Kush by spies and adventurers. Now what we're seeing here, if you like, is this sort of new geopolitical competition between the US and Russia. That US needs Central Asia to, if its new Afghan policy is going to have any chance of success. But at the same time, Russia very jealously regards Central Asia as its backyard. Now, what happened in 2001 after 9/11 was that Vladimir Putin, the Russian leader, and the former US President George Bush cut a deal with Putin, basically allowing the US to establish military outposts in Central Asia as part of its Afghan campaign. Now, what we've seen since then is really the Americans sort of turfed out and Russia really reassessing itself in this region. Now, what we have to wait and see is whether this new push by the Obama administration will work.
Luke, what do you think what's your take on this? Do you think that it does have an opportunity to work? And if so, how that might impact on, I suppose, the success of the US in Afghanistan?
Well, I think it's absolutely vital. But the problem the US faces is that its foothold in Central Asia is very weak. It's been trying to sort of support opposition groups here, civil society groups, but essentially it's got really nowhere at all. These are very autocratic countries run by, you know, a bunch of kind of democracy-adverse strongmen. And so that's pretty difficult. And at the same time, looming over all this is Russia. And I think that the Kremlin will be very keen to make sure that any deal which allows the U.S. to you know, use Central Asia again will be brokered through Moscow and not bilaterally. So basically Russia is saying that it will help, but only on condition the Obama administration sort of addresses its wider strategic concerns over other issues, things like missile defense in Europe and the expansion of NATO. The only thing I can say is that these NATO trucks, when they start rolling, they're expected in the next few weeks, past the most terrific scenery. I drove to the small border town of Nizhny Panj yesterday, which is where this new crossing will be. It was a sort of river crossing in a bridge built by the Americans. And the road takes you through kind of rolling green pasture full of red poppies and lilac flowers, and the whole, you know, you get past donkeys, small boys selling fish. I mean, it's a very fragrant spring landscape and a kind of delightful trip. And I talked to one Afghan traffic driver, that sort of lorry driver there, who sort of said, yeah, you know, the northern route is very attractive, and try heading south towards, you know, the Taliban-controlled areas, and it's just, you know, very, very dangerous. He much preferred that route, and I can see why.
Luke Harding reporting from Dushanbe. French rappers have a proud history of offending the country's right-wing governments, but they rarely manage to offend both extremes of the political spectrum. However, the son of a head teacher from rural Normandy, who's known as the French Eminem, has managed to do just that. Angélique Chrysaphis in Paris has more on the story.
He's best known for being this rapper from a dull town in Lower Normandy. He's not from the normal high-rise estates. What he normally raps about is the sort of boredom and hopelessness of French provincial teenagers and sort of rural drug epidemics. But this is a song which dates back 2 years, and it's about what he wants to do, beating up his girlfriend who he caught cheating. It's pretty sexually explicit and it's very violent.
So why has it come out now then?
Well, it's just basically, Orelsan, like many people in France, it came to light on the internet. He's just produced his first album, but this is a song that dates back 2 years. It's always been out there, but it's really come to the attention of feminists, the Communist Party, the Socialist Party, and now the government.
So what has he said in his defence?
Well, he says that he's not a misogynist, he's never beaten up a woman, and he was singing in character. Basically, he's known as a French Eminem, because he's this new white rapper in town. And I think he sort of said that Eminem is much more hardcore than me because I would never insult my mother. That's something he said in the past. But this time around, he says, this is a character, I don't mean it, and I'm sorry that I offended you.
No, he has done something rather unprecedented in that he's united the French left and right, hasn't he?
That's true. I mean, normally it's the French right having a go at rappers, and there have been several cases. In 2007, Monsieur R, who's one of Paris's most popular rappers, got off having been accused of offending public decency, saying that he wanted to piss on Napoleon and Charles de Gaulle and calling France a slut. And Nicolas Sarkozy, when he was Interior Minister in 2005, brought a case against another rap group for incitement to hurt or kill police officers. They got off as well.
Well, that's what happens when you have freedom of speech, I guess, isn't it?
Well, the Culture Minister did try and ban the song from YouTube and its French equivalent Daily Motion. They restricted access, but they refused to ban it.
What's happened since the political stink was kicked up?
Well, basically, Orelsan is on tour at the moment, and he's hugely popular in France. He's become a real kind of rap cult figure. And the politicians really wanted to see him banned from one of France's biggest rock festivals next month, which is the Printemps des Bourges. They've refused to ban him, saying, look, this song isn't on his album, and it's not part of his repertoire. So it looks like he's going to appear there, and he'll probably just get more and more popular than ever.
And that was Orelsan in less controversial mood with a track called No Life. That's all from Guardian Daily. Tomorrow's podcast will be available to download from 7 a.m. Today's producers were Phil Maynard and Doug Hardy. I'm Sonia Rothwell. Thanks for listening.